Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast from Runners Connect, where it's all about learning from the best and most inspiring minds in the sport. Together, we can train a smarter, healthier, and faster running community. Now here's your host, Sinead Hockey.
Hi everyone, this is Sinead back with you again for a very special episode of Run to the Top brought to you by Runners Connect. I hope you're having a great day and that this podcast makes it even better. As we enter the Bell app for 2017, I wanted to do something a little different for this week's episode. Just as you should look back on a race and extract all the learning moments, I wanted to take a look back and reflect on the best lessons our Run to the Top guests have taught us this year. And to do that, I asked listeners like you. Today's show will include Run to the Top's greatest hits of 2017, as chosen by our very own listeners, both new and longtime runners who made great strides mentally and physically thanks to the wisdom, inspiration, and perspective our guests have provided this year. Today, those runners will be sharing their favorite episodes and what they gained from them. And I'm so excited to jump in and share everybody's stories. Whether you've been listening to the podcast since its beginning or you discovered it last week, I really hope this collection of episodes serves as a springboard into a new year of PRs and happy running. Before we jump in, if there is an episode you really like and you want to listen to the entire thing, you can find the links to each episode in our show notes at runnersconnect.net/RC2017. As usual, after a quick break to thank our sponsor, we'll jump right into it. Did you know you can save on life insurance just for being a runner? Health IQ is an insurance company that works to reward health-conscious people like you with lower insurance rates. To see if you qualify, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/runnersconnect or mention the promo code RUNNERSCONNECT when you talk to a Health IQ agent. Hey guys, we're back and starting it off with a little segment from Danny Dreyer's episode on Qi running. An ultramarathoner and running guru, Danny Dreyer is the co-founder of Qi Running, which blends the inner focuses of Tai Chi with running to boost performance and reduce injury. Danny's helped thousands of runners reach new levels through Qi Running, including our very own Run to the Top runner, Jill Whitaker. Jill says, "I have always liked the principles taught in Qi Running, and it seems I always need the reminders to revisit those. Whenever I get a refresher on Qi running, my running seems to improve. Why can't I keep that in mind all the time?" Definitely know how that goes, Joe, but I hope this serves as a nice little refresher on the principles of Qi running. Here Danny shares how Qi running affects things like cadence and stride rate, and how exactly it works to reduce injury. I hope you enjoy it.
So there's basically, you know, three or four steps to it. But it's kind of like yoga. I could tell you how somebody should do a downward dog and somebody could spend 30 years trying to figure out how to do it, you know? So I'll give you the steps. And so the first is getting your posture nice and tall. And how I tell people is just, you know, lift at the crown of your head. Easiest way to do it. Just lift up at the crown of your head. Like in yoga class, they say, you know, pretend you got a piece of string tied to the crown of your head. Lift up really tall there. And as you lift up really tall there, you will notice a couple things happen. One of the things that happens is that you'll feel your core engage. If you stand up right now and really lift through the crown of your head, make yourself taller, you will feel all the muscles in your lower abs engage. That's all you need. So when you talk about needing core strength, it doesn't mean that you go out and do a bunch of crunches and rows and all kinds of stuff. You just have to get your posture tall. That will engage your core. So once your posture is nice and straight, then I have people fall into a nice, easy forward fall. And the easiest way to do that is, since it comes from Tai Chi, remember I mentioned the Dantian, your center, it's just below your belly button, about three fingers below your belly button and about 3 inches in. It's like right in the center of your body. If you can imagine what the center of mass of your body would be, it's about there.
Okay.
It's just a location, just a location. So I have people put their mind on that location, just focus there. And then all you do is move yourself around by moving that location, that part of your body. So what I tell people to do is get your posture tall, then move that part of your body just ahead of where you feel your feet hitting.
Interesting. Okay. That makes sense.
That totally creates the forward lean. And then all you have to do, the last part that's easy, is you just have to pick up your feet to keep up with your fall. You're not pushing your legs to get yourself to go forward. You're falling forward. Gravity is doing all the work. So you just have to pick up your feet to keep up with your fall.
Interesting.
So picking up your feet for however long you want to do it. If you want to do a marathon, you want to pick up your feet and fall forward for 4 hours or 3 hours or 5 hours, however long you want to do that. You train yourself for that. But you don't train yourself to push yourself around with your legs for 3 or 4 or 5 hours. That's a lot of work. You know, strengthening your core by just making your posture nice and tall is way less work. Plus, when you're in chi running, the other part is once you start moving forward and you're holding this, your center, just what it feels like is ahead of where your feet are hitting, then your next job is to relax your legs as much as you possibly can. Like, don't use the muscles. The only time you use your leg muscles is for that momentary support between strides. That's when you come back to your posture stance on one leg, right? So it's only for support. That's all your legs are for. So you are completely falling forward, picking up your feet to keep up with your fall. So if you were to stand up at your desk right now and run in place, you know, you wouldn't last very long, you know?
Yeah.
Your shins had hurt, your calves had hurt, everything had to go wiped out pretty quick. If I had you stand up from your desk and just pick up your feet, now that's a whole other thing. That's much easier to do.
Definitely. It really sounds like it's just completely reducing the cost of energy required to run.
Yeah, when you're doing chi running, when I go out for a run, I don't drink as much water as the people I run with. I hardly ever fuel, and there's no recovery time because what have I done? I mean, gravity is pulling me. Where's the work? The road is coming by and sweeping my legs rearward, out from under me. And I haven't really done that much work. And so even when I run a marathon or half marathons, we've had so many people write us letters and go, oh my God, I can't believe I actually just ran a half because I really don't feel like I did that.
That's amazing. So it sounds like I've actually read where chi running, you don't bend your knees as much as you do in traditional running. So does this have any effect on cadence and stride rate, or does it benefit it, or does it maybe take away from it?
There's a difference. It's in terminology. You do bend your knees, definitely, but you never lift your knees.
Oh, okay.
There's where the work happens. You know, you ever stand in place and run in place by lifting your knees as opposed to lifting your ankles. There's a whole lot of different work going on there. So I definitely coach people to bend their knees. That's how you get, as your knees bend, as you pass over your support stride, then it turns into a very circular stride. It looks very circular, like your feet are going around in a wheel motion, you know, like you're pedaling a crankset to a bicycle.
Wow. Okay. I'm visualizing it. It does make sense. So how long does it usually take when you're instructing somebody to alter their training or alter their technique to reflect this chi running technique? How long does it take for them to accomplish it? Does it take a few weeks to really get the motion down?
It depends how connected people are in their body. You know, I've had people get it in 30 minutes. I've had people take 3 months.
Wow.
So somewhere in that range, you know? And like I said, it depends how much you practice and it depends how connected you are with your body. But it's definitely, people notice the difference right away in the ease of motion. So it's all about economy of motion. You're not using as much motion, but as you said before, it's also about reducing your impact. So not only you're getting faster, easier, but you're not creating any impact, which can wear out your muscles, joints, you know, break bones, things like that.
Definitely. And so Danny, how does this help injured athletes, and how does it also help prevent injury? I know you've had a lot of clients that you've helped get through injury through this technique. So how has this helped them do that?
So there's two types of injury. Okay. impact and overuse. Okay. An impact injury usually goes to the joints, right? Because if you're hitting hard, it's got to impact your where the bones connect. Okay. So impact injuries hit your joints. That's how you get broken bones, metatarsal stress fractures, you know, runner's knee, all of that stuff. And then there's overuse injuries, which means, like I explained before, that you're using, they're overusing some muscle. And usually it's in your lower legs. So if you're pushing off with your toes, you're using little tiny muscles to push your body forward. And so that's an overuse injury when you get a plantar fasciitis or a calf pull, Achilles tendon pull. All of those are overuse. And so what Qi running does is it reduces the impact because you're no longer overstriding and hitting out in front of yourself. So it reduces the impact. It also keeps you from bouncing so much because when you're a bouncy runner, that's also increasing your impact. And then it reduces the overuse because all of a sudden you're relying more on the fact that you're falling forward and gravity is helping that. And so you actually are reducing the work of your muscles. And if you're using your core to actually keep your posture tall and hold you in a forward lean, and you're only just picking up your feet off the ground, not pushing off, that significantly reduces the amount of propulsion done by your legs, the amount of overuse that you could ever incur. And so we've just designed the whole technique to, you know, reduce effort and reduce injuries because it's more economical and because you're smoother along the ground. So I love that phrase, run yourself into the ground. How a lot of people run is they run into the ground instead of across the ground.
Oh, so that's a good way to put that.
I get people into this really Zen thing. Like, you know, feel like you're floating across the ground. Like you really don't even want to touch the ground. So I tell people, you know, you got to run like you're trying to sneak up on somebody. That's how you run softly. Because if you're clunking along, landing on your heels, slapping the ground with your feet, you're hardly going to be able to sneak up on somebody.
It's true. Almost treat the ground like hot lava, it sounds like.
Exactly. Like hot lava, like you're one of these firewalker crazy guys, you know? And or thin ice, you know?
Yeah.
Or, you know, whatever image you want that really keeps you light on your feet. And in fact, you know, I've run on a beach right next to somebody who weighed exactly the same as me, and I leave less footprints. So
wow,
go figure that, you know, people go, no, man, no way. It's absolutely true because I'm not coming down onto my feet. I'm running across the ground.
That's so a good way to put that. So
yes, you come down on your feet. Your body, when you're running, your legs have to carry up to four or five times your weight. But if you're running across the ground, you can reduce it down to just your weight, and then your legs are used to that.
Hey guys, hope you enjoyed that little piece from Danny Dreyer. Keeping in line with the same topic of running form, next up we'll be hearing a little from our interview with coach, runner's world writer, and author of Your Best Stride, Jonathan Beverly. Emily Jo Peterson of Milwaukee, Wisconsin says, "This podcast was a game changer for me. It helped me understand the importance of cross-training and building stability in your core. I actually was able to finally understand what engage your core means. Because of this podcast, I purchased both books by Beverly, and I have seen speeds I haven't seen in years. It was perfect timing, too, as I was sidelined for having a weak core and glute issues. Now I am stronger than ever." Like you, Emily Jo, this was one of my favorite interviews because Jonathan just really reminded me that runners come in all shapes and sizes, and because of that, there is no universal perfect stride. There's just the one that's best for you. In this segment, Jonathan explains why foot strike is overrated and how to counteract certain lifestyle habits like sitting all day that can actually be detrimental to your stride.
People, the majority of people don't adapt just to changing shoes. That if you put on minimal shoes on a person who's used to heel striking and wearing, you know, a traditional control shoe, they will still heel strike and actually have more impact because there's less cushioning there. It is not an automatic conversion that you put on these shoes and you'll run better. I think it encourages it. It's in one way of shaking things up. But all the people I interviewed, again, from even Irene Davis, agreed that, you know, foot strike, or and Dan Lieberman, the one who wrote Born to Run, the Nature article that, you know, that spawned all this, said, if I had known how much, I would have said foot strike is one thing, one element, but there are a lot of things that are important in the stride. And he said, you know, the worst thing to tell somebody is to focus on landing on your forefoot. And that was universal, that just saying to someone, you should land on your forefoot, is going to create a train wreck, that you can't just think about it and change it. So what people agreed on is that foot strike is more of a consequence than a cause. Mm-hmm. So yes, you probably are, you're going to end up at the end of the process of improving your stride with either a 4 foot strike, or maybe better to say, I think, you know, a 4 foot oriented stride. I mean, there are very effective heel strikers who don't overstride, don't break with their heel. It's just sort of a kiss, you know, a touchdown, and then rolling quickly. And still the majority of the weight and the force of the stride is on the forefoot, because then that's where you're pushing off. So foot strike is overrated because that became the focus. It's easy to see. It's easy to, you know, like I said, if you look at Kenenisa Bekele, you say he's landing on his forefoot. So that's something. But what's more significant is that's the end of what's happening. And it's the kinetic chain starts at the hips. And if your hips are off, then everything else is going to be off. And so the focus needs to move up and say, okay, this is the consequence of an effective stride. It's not the cause of it. And if you try to correct the consequence without addressing the cause, you end up with a mess.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, like you said, there's just almost too much emphasis placed on the shoe itself rather than somebody's actual running stride and what they can do beyond the shoe. So Jonathan, you, in your book, you maintain that there is no correct stride conducive to optimal performance for all. And this does kind of go against the grain of what we runners are usually taught. So why is this? Does everybody just have their own stride signature?
Yes. And I like that term, stride signature. That's a term that Brooks Running Company used. Benno Nigg, who's one of the world's leading researchers in this area, wrote The Biomechanics of Running Shoes and has done a lot of work. He calls it preferred movement pattern. And basically what it comes down to, I mean, you can think of your stride like your voice. And I'm hearing you talk now. It's the first time we've talked, but the next time I hear you, I will recognize you, that you shouldn't sound like me. You sound like you. Your vocal cords are different. The, you know, the length of your neck is different. The size of your lungs are different. All those things go into creating your voice. And the same thing with your stride. Your limbs are different lengths. The tightness of your joints are different. The ligaments move differently. You're asymmetrical. No, nobody is perfectly symmetrical. And what's awesome about the human body is that, you know, if you built a machine that way and things weren't exactly the same, the right length, it wouldn't work. It would just break. But the human mind, the whole system, the neuromuscular system, maximizes your best stride. And I mean, that's the name of the book, is that your body knows how to run. And it runs in a unique pattern that is your preferred movement pattern. This is the path of least resistance for your body to move in this way. And when you're young, that is the optimal way. You know, when everything is moving the way it's supposed to be, the way you were born to move. And so this is where we get into the problem. Okay, if everybody runs the way they're supposed to run naturally, then why do we even need to focus on this? And some people argue that, you know, just go run a lot, and you'll optimize. And there is some truth in that too. Your body just becomes more efficient as it gets tired. It finds the path of least resistance. But, and I don't know if you want me to keep going here, but this is the thesis of the book, the other side. You know, so that's sort of one myth, is that all we have to do is just do run the way we want to run. But the counteracting to that is that our lifestyles then compromise that. We're not spending our time up and running and walking most of the day. You know, we end up sitting from the time we're 4 or 5. most of the day in school and then at work, and then in the evenings while we're watching TV or on the computer or reading, or, and then while we're driving, and all this time we're not moving. So we're compromising our movement patterns. And so then our body is still trying to find the optimal pattern, but it's working with compromised parts.
Absolutely. And it's funny. You just said that, you know, at the age of four, we're fairly new to running. We haven't accumulated all of these different lifestyle habits that are detrimental to our form. And so our preferred movement path is a little more natural at the age of four. But what goes into really affecting our different strides between sitting down all day and being on our phones, driving? What are all these different lifestyle habits kind of detrimental to our stride?
Absolutely. And I think you've read the book, so you're pointing out the key aspects, but it's not unique, obviously, to this book. I mean, everywhere you look now, it's the perils of sitting and what sitting does to us. But in terms of stride, what it does is that, you know, at the hip, rather than, you know, a straight line from shoulder to ankle, the majority of time we have a right angle at the hip or more forward hinged. And that is the natural way that the hip bends. But it also is supposed to do a hip extension, which is from the hip, so you think the thigh going backwards. Because we've been sitting so long, a lot of us can't actually do that anymore. It's so tight on the front of our hips that we can't extend the knee back from the hips. If we try, what happens is it's sort of like opening a screen door that only has a hinge one way. If you're pushing it the other way, you're basically breaking the door frame. You know this? So you break the door frame by twisting the whole pelvis and moving with your back, so arching your back more. So that's the biggest compromise, in that a stride, an effective stride, should land near your body and then drive out behind you. If you can't extend your leg out behind you, your body finds different ways of doing that. And that leads to the overstriding, where you're reaching in front of you. You don't have any choice. If you can't stride behind you, the range of motion is going to be from in front of you to beneath you.
Very
so that's the biggest thing. And then the other, you mentioned the hunching over the computers, over the phones. And this is part that I expanded in the book that wasn't in the article, is I think upper body has gotten less attention than it deserves, even in relation to this. Even people who have bought into the improving their hips, if you've done that, if you still have a hunched, rotated, forward rotated shoulders, then your arms are going to be in front of you. And almost all the stuff we do, driving, working on the computer, your arms are in front of you. We do very little that our arms go behind our body. But an effective arm swing, in fact, this is something else you can look at with the elites, this is universal, is that you'll see their leg is coming back from the hip and you see their arms are driving back. There's a triangle, open triangle between their torso and their arm at the back of their arm swing. But again, this is one thing you can cue, but a lot of us are so tight in our chest and so rotated forward that it just takes a lot of effort to get our arms back there. And we need to, again, work the muscles and get ourselves back to a neutral alignment so that we can do that naturally.
Interesting. So obviously, a lot of us do things throughout the day that require our arms be elevated before us, whether it be driving or sitting at our computer, maybe even scrolling through our phones. So what effect does this have on our arm carriage and our overall running gait efficiency?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is the keeping. I'm coach cross country, so I see this morning we're doing morning running, and I'm watching particularly girls. I don't know why. I think for various reasons tend to keep their arms right there in front of the body, and if you're not swinging backward, then your weight is balanced more forward, and if your weight's balanced forward, then your legs are going to come forward to catch that. It affects the posture. It affects, then, as you said, you have some crossover. If your arms aren't going forward and back, they're going back and forth. They're moving some way, and which isn't ideal. But I think most importantly is the balance. You can't get tall, and getting tall is the key here. You're getting your torso up, your shoulders back, and then your hips rotated, so you're stacked. Bobby McGee, Boulder coach, says that, you know, you're stacked up. And when you're stacked, you feel this connectedness that, okay, I'm balanced over my feet just comfortably, and I don't have to work to keep myself there. And then you just start moving forward and your feet just flick you along. And the upper body is really significant in this, because if you're losing that balance, then you're just holding yourself upright is the first step. And every stride is trying to keep yourself upright. So getting your shoulders back, getting your arms back to a backwards drive. You know, the majority of the drive is behind your body, and then it's just a recoil coming back. And as you drive back, then your leg's going to drive back rather than reaching.
Don't forget, if you liked what Jonathan had to say and you want to hear more, you can find the link to his full episode in our show notes at runnersconnect.net/RC2017. After the break, we'll hear from Run to the Top runner Dave Wilkins of Kingston, Ontario, and also our very own editor, Jeremy Nessel, on their favorite episode of 2017. This is Sinead Hockey, and you're listening to Run to the Top at Runners Connect. Ever wonder why we get penalized by life insurance companies for things like family history and BMI, but we don't get rewarded for, you know, running and being active? If you can save money for being a good driver, it only makes sense that you should save money for living a healthy lifestyle. And Health IQ agrees. Health IQ is an insurance company that uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people like you and me. And that's pretty amazing, given science shows risk of heart disease is 49% less and risk of all-cause mortality is 30% less for runners than it is for the average Joe. Not such a bad bonus for logging some miles. And what I really love about Health IQ is that you can actually submit your running logs to get lower rates. All you have to do is plug in your data from Strava, Runkeeper, Garmin, and even your latest race results to save as much as 25.5% on your life insurance. To see if you qualify, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/runnersconnect or mention the promo code runnersconnect when you talk to a Health IQ agent. Thank you so much to Health IQ for sponsoring Run to the Top and for rewarding runners for doing what they love. Hey guys, we're back with our greatest hits of 2017 and an episode that happened to air just last week. A world-renowned sports psychology expert and the author of a new book called The Brave Athlete, Dr. Simon Marshall helps runners build up their psychological arsenal to conquer negative thoughts and anxiety holding them back. Dave Wilkins of Kingston, Ontario says, "Awesome episode. I'm very impressed with Dr. Marshall's understanding of the athlete's brain and how to overpower it when it's working against us. I'm excited to get his book." Like Dave, our very own editor, Jeremy Nessel, especially loved this episode, saying, "I know it just aired and I already listed a bunch of my faves on a recent episode, but Dr. Simon Marshall was full of helpful info and fun, even if NC17, or maybe NL17. I have been so much more aware of my chimp brain, and I'm surprised at how dominant it can be. But I guess it has seniority up there, for now." If you missed this episode and have no idea what Jeremy means by chimp brain, don't worry, Dr. Marshall explains it all in the segment to follow. And like Jeremy mentioned, there is a little bad language in this one, so if there are any small ears around, might be a good time to put your headphones in. Without further ado, here is Dr. Marshall.
Yeah, and in fact, it's important to point out here that, you know, thinking of the brain as has different parts and roles is not new. We certainly didn't invent that idea. Is you know, there's a lot of people have written about the fact that, you know, you might have seen the David Kahneman book Thinking Fast Slow, or Jonathan Haidt Happiness, and the notion that we've got like a voice inside of our head that's like, you know, the rational, so there's the emotional, impulsive side of us, then we've got the rational side of us. That notion dates, you know, is a very well established in psychology. But what we did is that we kind of tried to bring it into like everyday life, or use a metaphor that would probably be a little bit easier to understand. In fact, we didn't even invent that either. See, we really don't have much of an original idea at all. But it came from a guy called Dr. Steve Peters, who invented who kind of coined this chimp
brain metaphor. He's a forensic psychiatrist in Britain and a sports psychologist, and a fantastic. I recommend that book. It should be on every athlete's bookshelf. It's called The Chimp Paradox by Steve Peters. Get that. And so at its core is the fact that our brain, and I know I talked about this in the summit, so I don't want to sort of, you know, bore you senseless.
No,
here
that's
some
fine for, but... for our listeners that didn't catch that. Definitely glad to talk about it again.
Yeah. So, you know, our brain has evolved over millions of years, 5 to 6 million years, probably more actually, 5 to 6 million years. And it's evolved at different rates. Parts of our brains, you know, were there before other parts and so on. And our brain is just like a tree in that fact. If you cut open a tree and you count the rings in the middle, the part in the middle is the oldest part, and the part on the outside is the newest part. So the part you actually see when you look at a human brain, the wrinkly cortex part on the outside, that's where all of our rational, logical thinking happens. And that only really started to develop over the last 2 million years. So for 3 or 4 million years, we didn't really have much of a frontal cortex at all. We only had what we call a limbic system. There are other parts of the brain as well we had, like the brain stem and the cerebellum and other things. But in essence, this limbic system, kind of the size of an avocado, that sits right in the center of our brain, that sits atop your brain stem. And that's where all of your emotions are generated. It's where a lot of structures that you might have heard of, like the hippocampus and the amygdala and all these sort of old Latin sounding names, these structures in there. And it's very primitive. It's been there. And its goal is to keep us alive. So it feeds us very powerful sort of feelings and impressions to get us to run, fight, or hide, right? It's the fight or flight response. That's where it all is located in the limbic system, or the chimp brain. And we call it a chimp because it acts very much like a young primate. Sometimes it can be soft and cuddly. Emotions that we get are positive and lovely to have. But others are really frustrating, or they can be angry, or they can be, you know, desperate to have some need met in us. So all of our emotions, the reason humans have emotion is to drive decision making. So we need this part of our brain. But the trouble is that the survival instinct that it has was developed or formed millions of years ago. And so now our lives are rarely in danger. In fact, if you live in the suburbs and we just, you know, we have boring jobs and we like to train and race, very rarely are we going to be in true life or death situations. But your limbic system doesn't know that. The amygdala, a little part of your limbic system, like a little sensory radar, picks up information from your senses, from your ears and your eyes, and all your senses, and it processes them 5 times quicker than the rational, logical professor brain of yourself. So it's processing information in your environment very quickly. And then once it's processed, it kind of decides what's threatening or not. And it's using kind of prehistoric logic, right, to determine what's threatening. And it sets off a whole cascade of hormones and neurotransmitters in the brain to get us primed and ready to run, fight, or hide. And even, in fact, there are some things that it's worried about, like protecting us from being the holy trinity of being a scaredy cat for your brain, or where your brain will literally shit the bed if you force it to do this, is to be humiliated, embarrassed, or shown to be inadequate, right? Those three things. So if you ever put yourself in situations where that's a possibility, of course your brain is going to crap the bed and say, don't do this. What are you doing? Do something that you're good at. Fine, you don't need, or make up some reason why, an excuse not to go. And the reason for that is because millions of years ago, being humiliated, embarrassed, did actually mean a pretty miserable future, because you got ostracized from your troop, you had to forage for your food on your own, you had to defend yourself, and you probably would die. So, but nowadays we don't. It's just kind of ridiculous that we still get wired. But that fight or flight response is still there. So meanwhile, in normal, rational, logical land, in the professor brain, which is the real you, so when you think about what you want to do with life and what's important and your ability to do math and think about how do I qualify for Boston, and whilst also I must watch Stranger Things, I'm on episode 5. The way that we think about lives is all your professor brain. It's all an analysis, logic, and rational thinking. And of course, if that's all we had, if we didn't have a limbic system, we'd always make perfectly rational, logical decisions. We'd be boring as anything, but we'd always make rational decisions. And if we only had a limbic system, a chimp and no professor, we'd be in jail, all of us, because we'd steal, we'd hump anything, whatever urge we felt, we'd just get that need met. We don't care about other people's feelings and so on. So now we've got a bit of a problem on our hands, because on the one hand, your chimp brain is saying, why have you signed up for this half marathon? You know, you've never been out. This is your first time. You probably can't go this, and you haven't really done the training, and all the people out there, the real athletes, what are you doing? The chimp talk, which is, you know, very powerful in telling us to find another thing to do instead. Don't do this. Mm. But meanwhile, your professor brain is saying, but I've paid $175 for this, and I've done the training, and I've paid a coach. And if I don't get out of bed at 5:30, I'm not going to get the training down, and the logic of it. And there's a fight going on between part of your head that wants to keep you away from potential embarrassment, and there's a part of your brain that says, come on, it's just a damn race, you can do this. And most of the time, we lose that fight, because the chimp is five times quicker and five times stronger than you, than the real you, your professor. So our puny professor brain is trying to say, listen, you're standing on the start line, and you have what psychologists politely call thoughts of escape. And what that means is, oh my God, why am I doing? I'm never doing this again. Who talked me into this? I'm never fucking doing this again. This is miserable. You know, you're praying for it to be cancelled or something, you know. And so the net result is that we go through life and we approach our sport with a feeling of mental anguish, or having these thoughts and things that we don't want. And that simply reflects that your chimp brain has got the better of you. It's hijacked your brain as an in charge of you. So that's what we're trying to battle what's what the book's designed to do. And that's why this mental model, to understand that at the source of all these problems, whether it's I feel fat, or I wish I felt more like an athlete, or setting goals, it comes down to a battle between brains. We haven't talked about the computer brain. We don't need to do that for now. There is another brain involved, but in essence, we need to win that fight. And in fact, we often say, you know what? You don't even have to win it. You just have to be very good at becoming a cattle wrangler, a chimp wrangler. We have to manage it just as you would if there was a toddler having a tantrum in the grocery store. If you just try and go hard-handed, it rarely works. We have to use bribery. We have to use kind of soft talk. We have to kind of use all the tricks that we can to talk the chimp off the ledge and to go back in its cage and back to sleep, so we can get, you know, back on with just the normal routine thing of running.
If that piqued your interest, you can listen to Dr. Simon's interview in full through the link in our show notes at runnersconnect.net/RC2017. I also can't recommend his book, The Brave Athlete, enough. It should seriously be on every runner's bedside table. So if you're listening to this episode in December 2017, be sure to enter to win a free autographed copy of The Brave Athlete by joining our winner circle at runnersconnect.net/winner. We're extending the contest to January 1st at 12 p.m. Eastern, so get your name in fast. Our final greatest hit of 2017 is yet another that aired just a few weeks ago, but because it's one that resonated with so many listeners, I had to include it. During this episode, my boyfriend and our very own director of coaching at Runners Connect, Michael Hammond, shared his advice for keeping perspective in the all-consuming world of running. Here's what our listeners had to say. First, from Rick McCleary. To be honest, I've learned from every podcast, and it's been difficult to choose a favorite, but in the end, I chose Michael's. The running world can be all-consuming, and this podcast was just what I needed to hear right before the Christmas season. It helped me readjust my priorities to have a more meaningful holiday break. Since I'm in full Ironman prep and train 2 to 4 hours a day, it's an important reminder that family and relationships need to have a higher priority over the Christmas season, because missing the odd workout this early in the build isn't going to keep me from qualifying for Kona. Here's another from Run to the Top runner Jennifer Bartos. I really always love your podcast, but this one especially hit home for me. After a really crappy performance at Chicago Marathon a couple months ago, I've been really struggling to make peace with it. This podcast really has helped me a lot. My goals are very different from the super runners out there. I was trying to break 5 hours in my third marathon attempt in Chicago. The heat did me in. I had such a strong training cycle and had all kinds of personal wins this past summer and felt so prepared to crush my goal. And it just didn't happen, and I had the worst performance of all my marathons. I've been struggling to decide what to do next, and today, after listening to this, I know that I have to give myself permission to take whatever time I need to find joy. Also found the comparison part wonderful too. As a super slow runner, I often find myself sad or put down when I see all the fast people I follow on Instagram or Strava out there, and I wonder why I am not fast and when will it ever be that I can be like that. So thanks for the perspective of comparisons too. Love, love, love this one. Thank you so much. Thank you, Rick and Jennifer, for sharing your stories. And as you can tell from what they said, Michael's interview was one of this year's most impactful, and I think a really great way to bring in the new year. I hope you enjoy this little clip from his interview where he explains why you should never put too much stock into any single performance, good or bad.
First off, as I said before, we see this all the time. We see runners who run a race and it doesn't go very well, and they're just so incredibly upset about it. And I'm not saying that there's anything really wrong with that. I think when you work hard for something and you train for a long time, of course you're going to have, you're going to be upset. Of course you're going to be disappointed. Of course. But at the same time, in terms of how it negatively affects you moving forward, basically how it negatively affects you is if you have this bad race and you just let it totally bring you down. You know, I've seen people who there's two different ways that this can happen. One is I've seen people who will have a bad race and then you won't hear from them for a month. So let's say I'm your personal coach and we usually communicate like daily or every other day. And all of a sudden after a bad race, I don't hear from you for a month. You know, I don't even know what you're doing. Maybe you're not running at all. Maybe you totally went on a binge, whether it's food or just laziness, kind of couch potato, whatever it is. That's one option we see. I'd say actually though, the more common one that I observe is people who have a poor race and immediately take it to mean that they need to work way harder. So they'll have a bad race and then immediately they'll be like, all right, we got to get back to the drawing board. We got to implement some harder long runs. We got to up the paces, up the intensity. And neither of those options are good because you're totally, I would say it's kind of like a massive like exaggeration or overreaction in terms of your race, because really it's just one day. That's one day of 365 in a year, you know, roughly 30 in a month that you had this bad race on. That's it. That's the only time. It could have been, there's a million reasons, especially when we're talking about marathons, there's a million reasons why a marathon can go poorly, why any race can go poorly. It doesn't always mean that you're just in horrible shape, or that you trained incorrectly, or that you need to absolutely massively overhaul your entire training plan. I think a better response would be to look at it. And I actually got advice when I was first entering college, I was a freshman. I got some advice from an older runner on the team who was very successful. And she actually said, that after a race, whether it's good or bad, you need to take a very short amount of time. She meant like a day. And you kind of analyze it from a very analytical perspective, a very logical perspective, not an emotional perspective. So maybe you need to like wait 24 hours after the race and then do this, because that's when you're kind of raw about it, whether it's good or bad. But you basically take it, you look at it analytically and you say, what did I do right and what did I do wrong? And I think there's an important part there is, what did I do right? You need to think about what you did right as well, because in all likelihood, you didn't do everything wrong. Even if you had a terrible day, a bad race, there's probably some things that you did well. There's probably the fact that you finished. If you finished the race, that's doing something well, especially if it's a longer race and especially if it was going poorly. So I think looking at the things you did right, looking at the things you did wrong, I mean, from an analytical perspective, not like I'm such a stupid idiot. I'm a moron. I'm so bad. I'm not talented. I should quit. That's just negative talk, negative self-talk. That's not going to get you anywhere. And that's kind of what I was getting at before with just responding, kind of overreacting, but more from an analytical perspective. Okay, maybe you didn't take enough fuel in the first, 10K, the first 10 miles or so. Maybe you didn't take enough fuel in later. Maybe you weren't able to take in the fuel because your stomach was bothering you. Maybe you changed something up on race day. Maybe you didn't eat normally in the week beforehand. Those are the kind of things that you need to look at. And then after that, after you have that kind of that thinking period, and then you can go into kind of okay, how do I change this moving forward? After that, that should be the end of it. That should be the, because now you've taken the meat from it. You've taken what you need from the race. You've taken the lessons learned, and now you move forward. Now you got to get back to that stable kind of mental zone to where you're not super happy with if you had a great race. Yeah, you can still be happy, but you're not like on cloud nine, which can often lead to, again, either overtraining or totally going the opposite way and taking like way too long of a break, or whether you're really upset and disappointed and you just had a bad race. You kind of need to get back to that stable level in order to kind of get back into training.
That is something I've actually always admired about you, Michael, is you are so good at taking things in stride, whether they be bad or good races, and just staying level-headed and staying on course toward your goals. It's so important, and it's something that you've helped me tremendously with, so I'm glad we talked about that. But Michael, something you touched on there that I really thought was interesting was just remaining positive. This is so hard to do, especially after bad races, to really take away what we need to take away from a race and leave behind all the bad stuff. Usually the bad stuff overshadows the good stuff. So, Michael, can you tell us a little bit about how we can really achieve this? This is a hard thing to do, but how can we really achieve a positive mindset?
So I think this actually gets into, I think, kind of a broader territory than just running itself. And I think this is a huge part of staying positive, is kind of looking at things from a macro perspective, a bigger perspective than just running. I think, let's say running is just a huge part of your life. It's everything. Like you're always thinking about the next race. You're always thinking about the next workout. You're always so focused on that. And that's it. Like that's really the number one thing in your life, and everything else is really far down. Obviously, this probably isn't the case for, hopefully isn't the case for most people, because everybody has, you know, families and jobs and social lives and stuff like that. But if it's really, really high on your priority scale and you have a bad race, then that's going to be tough for you, because a huge part of your life, especially when we're talking about the marathon, I know I keep referring to that, but when you're talking about the marathon, that's maybe max of like 2 or 3 a year. So if you're running shorter races, 5Ks, 10Ks, you can just jump in another one next weekend if you want to. But with the marathon, there's this huge buildup, and it is a huge part of your life. I understand that. But I think a huge part of staying positive is putting things in perspective from a life standpoint, not necessarily just a running standpoint. Obviously, there's the running part of it, which is what I kind of touched on with the previous question about thinking of things from a logical standpoint, a rational standpoint, rather than an emotional one. That's a big one. And then I think another thing from a running standpoint is kind of always knowing that there's more ahead. You know, yeah, if you just ran a marathon, yeah, sure, the next one might be several months away, might be 3 to 5 months away, but it is there. It is around the corner. And we all know how quickly, I mean, we're nearing the end of a calendar year right now. We kind of all know how quickly months and several months can go by. So it is right around the corner. But from a broader perspective, I really do think it's very much about keeping things on an even keel and having your other priorities kind of take hold for a while. So after a marathon, you've been training really hard. You've been committing several hours a day, or at least like 4 or 5 days a week to this marathon, to the training. Now is a great time. I think it's a great time after a marathon or after a big race to kind of like step away from running for a while, to step away. You know, we usually give at Runners Connect, we usually give like a 3 or 4 week recovery plan anyway, most of which is just not running and maybe a little bit of jogging or whatever. But I think it's a great time to kind of close the training log. You know, if it's on your computer, don't even open it up for a little while. Go hang out with friends, go do stuff, go mountain biking, go for a long hike, go do stuff that you don't really do. Maybe you don't do during marathon training because it'll interfere with your own running. That's something that I used to do. I forbade myself from mountain biking, from long hikes, from playing tennis. It's a big one. I love playing tennis, basketball, just all these sorts of other things that I wasn't really letting myself do while I was training. After a big race, whether it's good or bad, is a great time to kind of get back to that stuff, because that'll help you put things in perspective. It'll help you keep a more positive mindset because you're having fun, you're hanging out with friends, you're doing things that you enjoy. And ultimately, if a month or two goes by, whenever you do decide to get back into running and get back into training and kind of get back into that mindset, you'll be a lot more fresh and you'll be entering it from a very positive standpoint rather than just spending that month or two you know, being negative, kind of beating yourself up about the race. And then you're just going to go into training beaten down, unhappy, and not really fresh and ready to tackle the next training cycle.
As with most runners, there have been times when running's taken up way too much residence in my head. And during those times, Michael's always helped me remember that running isn't who I am, and that it's just one of many priorities in my life. Again, to listen to Michael's full episode and all the others included today, you'll find the links to each one at the bottom of today's show notes at runnersconnect.net/RC2017. While there were a number of great suggestions as to which episodes to include in the show, due to time constraints, I could only include 4 episodes. But I want to say a special thanks to everyone who shared their favorite episodes and a little bit about how Run to the Top impacted them this year. Thank you so much to Jill Whitaker, Emily Jo Peterson, Dave Wilkins, Rick McCleary, Jennifer Bartos, Andres Duarte, Tenzai Afsa, and our editor, Jeremy Nessel. It was so nice to hear your stories, and I'm excited to bring in the new year with you. If you want to join in the discussion, or you'd like to be featured in an upcoming show, you can join our Run to the Top Winner Circle at runnersconnect.net/winner. It's an awesome community where our coaches, as well as runners like you, talk about everything from the podcast to their training, and we're always looking for more to join in the discussion. We'd love to see you there. Before I wrap this up, I also want to thank you for listening to Run to the Top. Whether these episodes were new to you or you'd heard them before, I hope the insights within helped you reflect back on the past year, evaluate your goals for the year ahead, and get ready to go out and make them a reality. Maybe after a few more festivities, of course. Thank you so much for joining me today, and Happy New Year. I hope it's your best one yet.
Thanks for listening to the Run to the Top podcast from runnersconnect.net.